The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
I was chatting with some people yesterday at a different sort of venue, and they said they didn't know who Richard Dawkins was. And so I thought it might be worthwhile. Most people have got some idea who Jesus is. Richard Dawkins is one of four men who are they call themselves the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They also call themselves the brights. So these are guys not struggling with low self-esteem. They're part of what's called the new atheism, which is only new in one or two features. It's really a standard argument. But it seems to have grown, particularly since September 11. Where people, I think, began to realize what I would think the Bible teaches all the time, which is that religion is not innocuous. Religion can be a great force for good and can be a terrible force of evil. And so I think it fired them up. And there's a series of books. Richard Dawkins has had a number, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, and at the moment I've forgotten the other horseman. But he's American and he hasn't had much impact here. So that's who Richard Dawkins is. He's a very enthusiastic atheist. And a scientist. He got his fame, I think, because of his work in the sciences. People foolishly say things like, you know, he's one of the greatest minds on the earth. That's nonsense. He's just well known. He has got a good mind. I wouldn't mind a debate with him, but I'd want months to prepare. And he's smarter than I am. But he wrote The Selfish Gene, which was not a great work of hard science. It was more an interesting theory and popularizing of science. His last few books have all been on the question of God, but he gets his credibility from his background in the sciences. Now, I'm aware I'm going to speak fast, particularly in this first section. Firstly, we're going to deal with what was the subtitle, why many atheists, scientists, and professors disagree with Dawkins. I want to look at that first before we get to the heart and soul of the talk on what would Jesus or what might Jesus say to Richard Dawkins and people like him, perhaps. I've got to be careful here. The guy's not in the room. You've got to be very careful how you read and listen to people who disagree with you. The natural human thing is not to listen carefully. A thing that I think Richard Dawkins does with sad consistency is to misrepresent his opponents, to not actually hear what they're saying. I've got to be very careful of doing that to Richard Dawkins. One of the Ten Commandments is, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And so I don't want to do that either. It is fair, I think, though, to discuss him even in his absence, because this is a quote from his his most famous book. He's got a better book which has just come out, which I'm reading my way through, which is back in the area of biology, where he's an expert. In the area of God, not so much, I think. But he's very blunt about the fact that he's attacking God. I'm attacking God, all gods, anything and everything supernatural, wherever and whenever they've been or will be invented. If this book works as intended, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. So it's clear, and I love an honest statement of where I'm going with the book. That's good to know. And he does. It's kind of a blitzkrieg. I don't think there's any area of Christian thought or basis that he doesn't have a go at. And he's even one of only two men I've ever read who actually attacks Jesus' moral teaching. We can come back to that in a question. But actually, I think, shows a total misunderstanding of it. And it's a misunderstanding that it's hard to justify, I think. But he's attacking, and what this is, in a sense, is a case for the defense. My relatives, one of my great uncles, landed at Gallipoli, and my emotions and passions were with Australia, but you cannot critique the Turks for shooting at the nice Australian boys. I mean, we attack them. And if you attack, you've suddenly got to give people a chance to defend, I think. If there's a case for the prosecution, which I think Richard Dawkins runs, it would be illegitimate for any of us not to say, well, I'd like to hear the case for the defense, unless we're prejudiced. So this is a very brief case for the defense. Richard Dawkins has been critiqued in both his manner and his argument by atheists quite severely. I'll give you an example. Professor Michael Roos, a very passionate atheist, professor of philosophy at Florida State University, his comment about the God delusion, the book, was this: "The God delusion makes me ashamed to be an atheist." He just thinks it's a disgracefully argued book, and the tone is also unhelpful. A Oxford professor of science said to Professor McGrath about the book and the television show that it was based on, he said it was pseudo-intellectual drivel. I've just not, in terms of the ABC and the Herald, and the ABC love and worship Richard Dawkins. They've had any number of opportunities to have an interesting debate where they put him up against, it doesn't have to be a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, anyone. It could be just another good scientist or philosopher, but they don't tend to do that. The only time I've seen him in a situation where he could debate, they chose probably one of the stupidest Christians I've ever seen on television. And I don't think he was chosen by accident. And he looked a goose. Professor Thomas Nagel, again, professor from New York University, passionate atheist, has said this, that Dawkins is operating mostly outside the range of his scientific expertise. So that when he writes this book, the reason we listen to it is because of his scientific basis. But this book is actually not about science at all. It's philosophy, it's theology, it's history. And I think actually Richard doesn't sometimes realize when he's moved right out of his area of expertise. So it's still a worthwhile book to read. I think it's fair to say that he's often writing outside of the areas that he really knows about. And that, I think, is a charitable judgment. Because if he does know about the areas, as one great professor in America said, Plattinger, said, this is worse than sophomore writing. So very junior university writing. Professor Francis Collins, you may know the Human Genome Program, which is one of the great triumphs of modern science, was begun, the head guy at the beginning was an atheist, and it was concluded by a guy who was a Christian, which I think is a nice sort of symbol of the unity that there is between science and Christianity and the either-or-ness of your religious positions. He writes, he himself became a Christian at the age of 27. He was already a professional scientist then. He says, Dawkins is a master of setting up a straw man and then demolishing with great relish. I think that's a fair call. Let me give you a summary of the book. He's got basically two arguments, if you haven't read it, which take up the 400 pages. The first one is that knowledge and rationality destroys religion. If you've got rationality and you've got a grip on the modern knowledge, particularly of science, it just destroys Christianity. You can't have both. So science is the superhighway to atheism. Science and faith are natural and mortal enemies. To think is the opposite of faith, he says. And almost all the Jesus story is false. So that there's no evidence really for his existence. The resurrection is a fairy tale. His moral teaching is corrupt. It's a good, wholesome blitzkrieg. The second part of his argument is that this God delusion, in any form, is degrading of human worth and it's destructive of human society and happiness. It is the public enemy number one. So to use the subheading of one of his mates, Christopher Hitchens, who writes, I think, much more formidably than Richard Dawkins, his subheading of his book, which was God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. That's the second main thing. So let's briefly have a look at some of these arguments. Richard Dawkins thinks that science is the superhighway to atheism. If you are an honest scientist, you will be an atheist. Now, he has to argue that very hard because the simple fact is that it's just not true. The scientific community is full, littered with people who are great scientists and true believers. So it's a counterfactual statement. But he's arguing it very passionately. One of his colleagues, in some ways, probably the other most eminent biologist in the second half of the 20th century, Stephen Jay Gould, an American, he's a paleontologist, that's his specialty, himself an atheist, writes this. Either half of my colleagues are enormously stupid, or else the science of Darwinism is fully compatible with conventional religious beliefs, and equally compatible with atheism. You can get the exasperation in this second quote by the same great scientific atheist. For the umpteenth millionth time, as far as the existence of God is concerned, we simply cannot comment as scientists. So a person might be a scientist who makes a comment about God, but they're not speaking as a scientist. They're speaking as a human who happens to be a scientist, any more than if a musician speaks about the question of God. It's not their musicianship. They may use that area to sort of supplement their arguments. So I think, Stephen, the idea that atheism is the inevitable fruit of science is not backed up by fact or clear thinking. The second great point of the book, Religion Poisons Everything, that when I was an atheist, which was up until I was about 19, if you asked me about my knowledge of church history, there were three things I knew about the history of religion. And I've been surprised how many people, even today at Sydney University, have got the same knowledge. That is, what's religion responsible for? The Crusades, burning witches, and the Inquisition. Now, it always ought to alarm us if we're thinking about any organisation if all we know about them is negative. Because I don't think you can find any organisation, well, maybe the National Socialists, but you can't, even they must have done some good somewhere. I mean, Mussolini had the trains on time, apparently. But any group of people who all our knowledge of them is negative probably means that we're the victims of informal brainwashing. So religion poisons everything. Well, just two comments there from non-religious people. Professor Roos, again, the atheist, he writes to Daniel Dennett, asking Dennett and Dawkins to, for goodness sake, argue sensibly. And here's from his letter. What we need is not knee-jerk atheism, but serious grappling with the issues. Neither of you, speaking of Richard Dawkins and Dennett, neither of you are willing to study Christianity seriously and engage with the ideas. It's just plain silly and grotesquely immoral to claim that Christianity is simply a force for evil, as Richard does. See, if I got up here and said that, you'd say, well, of course you say that. You're biased. You're a Christian. That's why I think it's interesting to see what others say who have a better knowledge of history and probably a fairer outlook. Michael Shermer, founding editor of American Skeptics magazine, a very fine intellect, he says this. For every one of the grand tragedies in which religion has been implicated, there are 10,000 acts of personal goodness and social kindness that go unreported. I think that's a fairer reading of the histories. As you go, there's an article by Matthew Paris that you might like to take. He's a very keen atheist, famous in England as having been in Parliament and as a gay activist fighting for gay rights. No great friend of the church. But he went back to Africa and wrote an extraordinary article. You can see it in the heading. As an atheist, I truly believe Africa needs God. He said, obviously, as Nelson Mandela says, the impact of missionaries in terms of schools and hospitals has been enormously positive. But he said, they next need Jesus, he thinks Africa does. And this is a much fairer reading of the history. You might like to take that and have a read, or you can look it up on the net. Just very briefly, getting more to the question of Jesus and Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins argues it's even possible to mount a serious argument that Jesus never existed. And then he'll speak about if he existed. Now that was, in terms of debating, you know, if you're involved in arguing with someone, if they say something truly stupid, it's kind of a good moment. And that is a remarkable statement for anyone who knows anything about the histories. It seems to be part of the new atheism, because Christopher Hitchens will argue the same thing, the highly questionable existence of Jesus. Michael Onfray, in his book The Atheist Manifesto, was brought to Australia a couple of years ago. Jesus' existence has not been historically established. And when they are then challenged, as Michael Onfray was, for where he would base that, who is there any historian that you know of who would argue that? He and Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins will point to this guy called Professor Wells, because he's the only guy who's tried to argue this in the last few decades. Now, it's interesting, until you start asking questions like, of what is he a professor? Ancient history? Classics? No. He's a German grammar professor. Now, that's a good thing to teach. I've got nothing against, and I wish I could speak German and read German. It'd be great. But they always call him Professor Wells because it makes him sound impressive, but his area of knowledge is, it's not even history generally. Dr. John Dixon, who many of you will know of, or some of you will know of, wrote to Professor Graham Clark, not a card-carrying Christian, but probably Australia's most eminent ancient historian at the moment, list of activities and awards that are terrifying, even those in New Zealand are. But we love our enemies. But he wrote this to John. John asked him, do you know of any historian who would argue for the doubtfulness of Jesus' existence? Graham Clark writes back, frankly, and he said the letter could be published, frankly, I know of no ancient or biblical historian who would have a twinge of doubt about the existence of a Jesus Christ. The documentary evidence is simply overwhelming. So it's hard to know why Richard and those guys would argue for the possible non-existence, except that they have something invested in it. Because no one starting from the histories would even think to to doubt that. Einstein certainly was fairly keen on the existence of Jesus. The last thing in terms of some of the factual queries about some of Richard Dawkins' assertions on the resurrection, this is a beautiful part of Richard's writing. He's a great writer, I think. He's good fun. He's got a great turn of phrase. The accounts of Jesus' resurrection are about as well documented as Jack and the Beanstalk. I think that's lovely in terms of writing. How is it in terms of evidence? Well, the list of people who've started off skeptically, either atheistic, quite a number of Jewish people, Professor Simon Greenleaf and one I'm going to show you in a minute, Pinchas Lapid, who are really not biased in favor of the resurrection, that their cultural leanings would make them, if anything, be skeptical of, you know, convince me if you can, who've actually looked at the evidence, have come away persuaded. The one just in terms of briefness, Professor Pinchas Lapid, a famous historian, particularly, he was a modern historian, particularly on the use that the Nazis made of the Vatican to escape Europe, which was not a moment of Christians are particularly proud of. But he wrote a book in 1988 which came out, which caught him in all sorts of trouble in his home communities. Orthodox rabbi. And he just took his historical skills to the question of the resurrection, which is the heart and soul, and everything in Christianity hangs on that. His conclusion was, I accept the resurrection of Easter Sunday not as an invention of the community of disciples, but as an historical event. Multiple people have done that same thing, where they start, when they look at the evidence rather than just mock it. So it's difficult when Richard will say things about the resurrection. You think, why? On what basis would he say that? I don't think he's embraced the challenge that I want to bring to you from Jesus here. So when we come specifically not to what some of other brilliant non-Christian men and women say about Richard's arguments, what would Jesus say to Richard Dawkins? Now, this is awkward, not because Jesus isn't in the room, because my understanding is that he is in the room, but I will have to answer to him, unless he is just an imaginary make-believe friend. But my understanding of Jesus is he is in the end, at the end of history, and I've got to be careful that I don't pour into Jesus' mouth my own words, which is very, very common all around the world. We just make Jesus an echo chamber of our own opinion. So I've read quite a few of the Gospels thinking, what is there anyone that Jesus meets that's something like Richard Dawkins? Well, there weren't too many Oxford-trained biologists back in the first century in Palestine. But I did find a man who had some similarities. He's successful, influential, powerful, skeptical, pragmatic, with a good turn of phrase. And in 1961, we finally dug up an inscription with his name on it. Because up till then, people used to play with the possible non-existence of Pontius Pilate. Pilate, born in Spain, rapidly rose through the ranks of the army, married the granddaughter of a previous emperor, got into the diplomatic corps, and got this great win of becoming a governor, until he opened the letter and found it was to Palestine. Because Palestine was a notoriously difficult, in fact, it was the kind of job as governor he didn't want, because the Jewish people were so thorough in their passionate commitment to the oneness of God, and it just was a difficult place for the Romans to work out how on earth to rule these people. So it's a bit like getting chosen for the Wallabies and then discovering that you're marking Jonah Loma or something like that. You think, is that a win or a loss day that day? Because you're going to have your hands full. So this is the man. He, in the end, as you probably know, he's the Roman procurator who has to make the verdict on the life of Jesus. And you can read this particularly in John 18. Interesting, if you read through the three or four trials Jesus went through, Pilate is the only man Jesus dialogues with. He won't answer the questions of Herod. He will not speak to his fellow Jews, because he says, you know what I've said. You know, you've got the evidence. I'm not going to answer your silly questions. Pilate, though, he does dialogue with. And I just thought we might look very briefly at that, because I think it will give us a clue to what Jesus might say to someone like Richard Dawkins or ourselves. Coming in partway through the story, Pilate goes into Jesus and says, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answers, somewhat surly, I think. Is that your own idea, Jesus asked? Or did others talk to you about me? Not how you answer the man who's got your life in his hands. Pilate answers again. I think he's feeling a bit cranky at this point. Am I a Jew? It's your own people and chief priests have handed you over to me. What is it that you've done? Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place. They have a brief conversation about his crime. And one of the things that is worth noting, and I presume you may have noticed, that Jesus' trial is quite unusual in history because he's not put on trial for something he's done or something he's planning to do. He's put on trial by his Jewish nation, he himself being Jewish, and by the Romans on the question of his identity. Who or what does he claim to be? The Romans were interested particularly in his claim to be king. And that's caught up in the word Christ, isn't it? We sometimes think that Christ is a name, like Mary and Joseph Christ gave birth to Jesus Christ. But Christ is actually a title. I won't bore you with the background there. It basically means the king. And so the Romans didn't care what you believed about God so long as you paid your taxes and obeyed them. You believe what you're flipping like. They were into multi-faith long before we were. Right? So long as you didn't claim to be king. This is, in the end, the reason Jesus was put to death. The question of his identity. If you are king, you will not tolerate someone else being king. So the CEO of Telstra, I know you're not all from Telstra, what's his name again? David? Okay, it's called David. See, I read about it, he said last week, David said, everyone's job's on the line, even my job's on the line. I thought, oh yeah, sure it is. But if I said to you, by the way, David has, his job was on the line, he's gone, and I'm the new CEO, I don't think David would take that very, I think I'd be escorted out of the building eventually. Because people who are in charge, if he's here, welcome, David. Authority is a thing which people fight for. That's why we don't like Jesus. Here I am projecting onto you what we see elsewhere in the Bible of my own. Why did I not want to be, why was I desperately fighting not to become a Christian even as I got persuaded? It's the four-letter swear word. L-O-R-D. We don't like the idea of there being someone who actually says, Ian, you don't belong to yourself. I'm your rightful master, ruler, and Lord. In the end, Caesar will have Jesus put to death on the question of his identity, even though, as he says, his kingdom is so weird that his servants don't fight for him. Right? That's one of the marks of Christianity. Our servants, you know, you can't fight for Jesus. People who say they are talking nonsense. So there's the question of his kingship. Jesus then changes the topic because he knows that kingship is so badly understood. And he says this. In fact, you can see it there. Pilate says to him, so you are a king. Jesus answered, you say I'm a king. In fact, for this reason I was born and came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. And Pilate's very famous retort, what is truth? Here Jesus moves the discussion from kingship, which he says, you're not going to understand my kingship because it's so unusual. He said, let's talk about what I normally talk, which is truth. Jesus says, I am the one who was born for the purpose. I don't know if you know the purpose of your birth, but Jesus was in no doubt. I came, he said, to bear witness to the truth. That is, to that which is real. The most dangerous guns in the world are the unloaded ones, aren't they? Like some of you, I had a friend of mine killed by an unloaded gun. Because the trouble with truth is, it doesn't matter what you think, if there's a bullet and you aim it at someone, and you pull the trigger, truth just trumps the myths and delusions that we have. That's the sort of truth Jesus speaking out. That which is true about you, about what really happens after death, about why we're here. Jesus says, I was born to point to that. And actually, earlier that same day, he has said, I am the truth. Which is a very interesting statement, how a person can be the truth. But that is what Jesus says. Then he throws out to him, Pilate, what I think he'd throw out to Richard Dawkins. Are you on the side of truth? Now, at one level, people can get offended by that. Well, of course I'm on the side of truth. Well, hang on, slow down. You probably have seen people who have used all their brilliant intellectual capacity to avoid facing the obvious. We've got that saying, haven't we? Denial ain't just a river that flows through Egypt. Right? We all have seen people who just won't face uncomfortable truths. And what Jesus says is, there's a bunch of people who aren't interested in the truth. Jesus says, everyone on the side of truth, what's the mark of that? He said, they will listen to me. And boy, if you can say that to Pilate who knew nothing of Jesus. For a person in our present world, with some understanding of the significance of the person of Jesus, who has never listened to Jesus, has never even read one of the four very short biographies. It's very hard to say, I'm genuinely interested in the truth. I'm just not going to read one of the tiny short biographies I could read in an hour or two of the most significant man in history. Jesus says, you want to know if you're on the side of truth? You'll listen to me. Since I've been working in the city, I've been asking a question to a number of people in the city, particularly men I've been asking for some reason, which is, since you became an adult, have you had the chance to read one of the biographies of Jesus? And you know, I've not met one man in the city yet, I'm sure they're out there, but I just haven't, it's a very small survey, who's not a Christian, who's able to say yes to that. And I'm troubled by that. People have all sorts of opinions. People will have read a book this big, 400 pages, and will have never gone to the source documents and listened to Jesus. Because the other question that I think is helpful, and I'm going to close up, is imagine if I could do this, and I can't, so don't panic. Imagine if, just as a thought experiment, if I could, in the next 30 seconds, give you magnificent evidence that there really is a God, absolutely overwhelming evidence, and that Jesus Christ is actually God's Son, and He really died for you so you could be forgiven, and He really rose again from the dead, and He's coming back as judge, and He's Lord of all those basic sort of things that Christians have always believed. If I could give you that evidence now, and I can't do it in a few seconds, would you be willing immediately to change the way you live? If I could persuade you, now don't answer it out loud, because if you ask the question out loud, we've all go, of course I'll follow the truth wherever it goes. Oh, you're much more complicated than that, Jesus says. Some people are on the side of truth, some people, for whatever reason, are not. But if you could be persuaded in an instant, would you in the same instant say, right, I will now live differently? Now, often it's our lifestyle that determines our beliefs, rather than our beliefs determining our lifestyle. There are things that we don't want to believe. Jesus is throwing out the question, I think, to Richard Dawkins, certainly to Pilate and to us. Are we people of the truth? Therefore, have we given ourselves a chance to look at the life of really the only person in history who says, I am the truth? On that note, I will shut up and we'll throw it open for questions. And please feel free. I long to be offended. I think some people think that religious people are very sensitive. Be as bold as you like. I live to be offended and it happens too rarely. So feel free to ask any question. Jelly bean for the first question is always the hardest. Yeah. Yes, just to make sure everyone said, how differently does a religious person live than an atheist? I think this is part of following Jesus. I'm not much interested in religion. I think religion is often a force for evil and social control. If you ask me about Jesus, though, how differently would an atheist from a follower of Jesus? Is what I've got more familiarity with. There will sometimes, perhaps at work, be very little difference. Jesus himself tells a story about how difficult it is sometimes to tell people apart, those who belong to his kingdom and those who don't, and we should avoid judging too early. I think the whole universe they live in will be different. To live in a universe where you understand that at the heart of the universe is actually love and God, and actually the Trinity, which is at the heart of what Jesus reveals, that there is actually a community of love that precedes energy and the Big Bang, etc. The Big Bang, by the way, is a theory that Christians love. It fits perfectly with what we've always believed. And it seems to be fairly solidly proven. You live in a very different universe if you're consistent than if you believe in the end the ultimate reality is just energy. And human life is just a passing fad of no ultimate consequence. But many atheists live very, very constructive, loving lives. Quite a lot of Christians live dodgy, broken lives. But there are great deal. I tell you the areas where I think the difference is really most obvious, and this is at the risk of being too specific. Loving your enemies is one of the distinctive calls of Jesus, which Richard Dawkins simply doesn't get. Jesus is completely unimpressed when people love their friends. As he says, the worst sinners in the world love their friends. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who mistreat you. I think that's one of the great differences. And you'll give with your money and time, not just your spare time and your spare money, but as a Christian, you'll learn to give like Jesus does, which is everything. So, at one level, lots of difference. Sometimes, not much. Is that... Do you want to come back on that? That's just my opinion, that one. There was another arm waving over here somewhere. Yeah. Look, I think Jesus raises, because he doesn't just do it here, he raises it in a number of places through John, in John 3 and 7, and then in chapter 12 as well. The fact that there's lots of times we don't believe the truth because we don't want to. So Jesus says, this is how the judgment works. Light has come into the world, but men prefer the darkness to the light because their deeds are evil. So Jesus has got, in a sense, some of the insights that are right, I think, about postmodernism. I think Jesus is right there before him, which is truth is not as easy as we like to think it is. People simply do not get persuaded by evidence if they don't want to. Convince a man against his will and he remains unconvinced still, they say. And I think that's true. I know no one. I used to say I know one person, but subsequently she told me one of the advantages of getting drunk, I think maybe the only one, is sometimes people are a little more honest. But she told me, I do know. I don't know anyone who's looked at the evidence for Jesus, who's read some Gospels and looked at the evidence for the resurrection, who's unpersuaded. I know lots of people who are unpersuaded, most of my family. But they won't look at the evidence. They won't even read a small article about the resurrection. So I don't think the problem is truth. I think the reason I became a Christian very reluctant was when I finally looked at the evidence. I was really angry when I became a Christian. I didn't need God. I hated Christians. They were dull and boring like their church services were. And the last thing I wanted to do was become one. But I got persuaded. And I think the evidence is clear. I think atheism, in the same way as atheism, they psychologize my belief that psychological weakness. That's what one of my brothers said to me. I said, I don't think there's any evidence that I'm weaker than you are intellectually or emotionally. Christians understand atheism, the Apostle Paul wrote this 2,000 years ago, as it's an act of denial. Atheists say Christians are projecting, a God figure into the universe. You can only say that if you know nothing about most religions, but that's what Feuerbach said, and Marx and everyone echoes it. And Christians say, well, actually what atheists are doing, they're engaged in the process of denial. They're suppressing the truth because it's so damned inconvenient. And the problem is the four-letter word. To actually say, all right, and to let Jesus then dictate how I treat my enemies, how I engage, how I use my sexual energies, all those things, that's a good reason to fight against it. All of us struggle, to be honest. But I think the evidence is overwhelming if we're willing to look at it. No, I think here. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. 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 Well, if they do, they're not reading the Bible. Yeah, I think if you read, how much time have we got? I think the story of Thomas is critical, because the only reason why his mates believed, because he just wasn't there. He was out fishing or doing something. And so the 10 remaining disciples, because Judas had committed suicide, the 10 remaining disciples tell him, we have seen the Lord. Now, he knows, as the early Christians know, that dead bodies don't get up. I've just been watching Lost, that TV, because one of my daughters is into it, and that, I think anything that will help me understand her world. So I've been watching it. And every second person who dies gets brought back. It's extraordinary. They're punched on the chest and a bit of mouth-to-mouth. People don't stay dead in television. But in the time of Jesus, they tended to stay dead, particularly if you'd been slaughtered by the Romans. The one thing the Romans were good at was crucifixion. And you don't survive crucifixion. There is no evidence of anyone. There was evidence of one man being taken down while alive, and, of course, he died. Medicine was not all that good in the first century in Palestine. So the early Christians, they didn't believe Jesus rose by faith in the way that Richard Dawkins says it. They believe because of the evidence. When the body is missing on the first Sunday morning, it's one of the great facts that you have to come to grips with. The body's not there on the Sunday morning. The early Christians, their explanation was, those filthy rats who've murdered him have now committed, you know, they've continued the humiliation. They thought that the Jews had stolen the body or the Romans. The Jews blamed the disciples. Everyone's, and it's only when the Christians see Jesus and touch him, and then, well, yeah, but Thomas only, he just said, I'll believe it when I put my finger in the holes with the nails and my fist in the hole with the side, but it's very, very graphic. Jesus turns up and doesn't say to him, dear Thomas, you really should believe without evidence. What Thomas says is, stick your finger in the hole, stick your fist. He says, if you're an empiricist, go for it. Just believe, because it's true. Yeah. Yeah, I think Thomas is a great example of the way the Bible thinks about evidence, which is, you should only believe something if there's good reason to believe it. As a matter, it's my parents' fault. I was born at the wrong time in history, so I couldn't be there at the resurrection at that time. I couldn't be part of that, which is true of almost every part of history. But we've got good laws, what's called sort of historical proof or legal proof, that sort of area of proof by which you can assess. It's the question that Jesus says, everyone on the side of truth listens to me. And I think the question is to say, have I ever taken the time to take my God-given brain or my universe-given brain, whatever you think it comes from, and actually inspect the evidence and not be prejudiced either for it or against it as far as we can. But it's very, very hard, because I like to think that if, as far as I understand myself, if evidence came up that there was no God and that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, I'm out of here. I'm going to stop being Christian, because I don't want to believe rubbish. I don't want to give my life to what's nonsense. That's just foolish. I could make more money, I think, doing something else. But what you might like to take, there's the Matthew Paris article. There's also one with comic strips on it, because it was designed for uni students. And it's a brief introduction to the evidence of the resurrection. There are whole great books written about it and great debates that have been had that have been printed. But you're welcome to take that as an introduction. The two questions, have we got time for any more, or should we let people go? I'm not going anywhere after this, though, so yeah. It's a shame that that's come up so late, because there's about seven or eight things that would be great to respond to in that. Of course, the world is awash in various religions. And religion, like anything, is in the hands of humans, abused and dangerous. And I think atheism, in its brief moments of when it's been in charge of countries, has shown itself to really be a horrendous system when it's pushed to its end. I actually think that when you talk about the massive complexity within Christianity, I happen to be an Anglican. I would be happy to belong to almost any The Jehovah's Witnesses have their own translation of the Bible, and they're quite clearly a cult. Well, I've done that many times, and they don't. They, in the end, they can't. So I think you're oversimplifying the complexity. In terms of the simple question which lies at the heart of Christianity, is Jesus Christ the Messiah, as he claims, and is he someone who brings the truth? They're the questions that I think any honest person who's able to have a chance to read the Gospels ought to do at least once in their life. And one of the questions that I had to work through is, yes, one of the beautiful things that you've got in the New Testament is, whenever in this translation, when there's any doubt about which is the best of the Greek manuscripts, they've got a footnote. Nothing hidden. There's no games being played. But the article on the resurrection has got one quote from one of the great scholars from the British Museum about the accuracy of the New Testament. And I think it's a very clear witness to the person of Jesus. And I think the best thing is to read it. I think the thing you do with any witness in the end is you let the witness speak. And it's just surprising how many people won't just to read. I think we just need to be informed. We should probably call it a day, or is yours a shorter one? Just very briefly on that. The trouble is this. I believe all sorts of things in science that I've read. It's one of the areas of sort of hobby reading, I think I'd describe it. When I read books about, say, the Big Bang Theory or guys trying to argue for string theory and other things, they're all believers. So people only write, or most people only write about something like this that they believe to be true because they're convinced. The great thing, I think, with the New Testament is, I remember I've watched a number of documentaries since I've become a Christian. I've just about given up on BBC documentaries about Christianity because they are so appallingly biased. And I remember the great one, because I just read a book by this man. He got up at the beginning of this BBC documentary, beautiful English accent in front of beautiful ivy-covered university. This is a program with no prejudices, no belief. It's just the honest facts about Jesus. The guy had just written a book, a wholesale attack on the idea that Jesus was actually God come to earth. And no one would know that except if you happen to have read it. So I think the person to be suspicious of is the person who says, I have no biases. We're all prejudiced. That you have a belief in something doesn't mean you are unable to write honestly. In fact, some historians have argued that if you believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God, as the early Christians did, you're more likely to write carefully. So one of the things I expressed was my concern not to artificially represent Jesus. What might Jesus say to Richard Dawkins? Because I actually think it really matters what Jesus says, and I will stand before him. So I'm a South Sydney supporter. I can describe to you the last game I went to where we flogged Canterbury. I can describe to you the game before that where we got beaten by Sydney City Roosters, sorry. That you're biased doesn't at all mean that you're incapable of writing down what happened. The nice thing I think about that, say John's Gospel, which I'd recommend, is John tells you why he writes. He said, I'm writing this that you might believe. So when people try to convince me of any scientific theory, are they biased? Of course they're biased. But what they say is, here's the evidence that's convinced me. Let me lay it out before you. And I think that's what Christians are saying. But I think one of the areas where I had to change when I became a Christian was I was a liar. And I was a very good liar. I lied in my university degree. I made up footnotes about books that I hadn't read. I lied to my girlfriend. When I became a Christian, one of the huge changes had I was no longer allowed to lie. And I think that does have some impact on the truthfulness of writing.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.